On this week's big show, G. Edward Griffin, author of The Creature from Jekyll Island, James Turk, head of GoldMoney.com, and Christopher Duane, sound money enthusiast. Hello, everyone. Your host, Chris Waldseck, back with you. We've got another big show lined up for you this weekend. In this encore episode, three top guests, Robert, Ian, and I, plus a whole new crew in a brand new show next week. Here is your mining quiz for the day, compliments of GoldSeek. Which company has the largest undeveloped gold reserve in North America? Seabridge Gold. Now, which company has the largest undeveloped copper reserve in North America? Seabridge Gold again. Seabridge has more gold reserves than Kinross, Yamana, and Agnico Eagle. Last year alone, Seabridge added 515 million tons of new inferred resources containing nearly 6 million ounces of gold and more than 6 billion pounds of copper at their giant KSM project in British Columbia, Canada. Now they are drilling at KSM again with multiple rigs in a 25,000-meter program. Find out more by visiting www.seabridgegold.net. Traded on the NYSE, symbol SA, and the TSX, symbol SEA.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.
Christopher Duane makes his debut on GoldSeek.com radio. He's the founder of Sons of Liberty Academy and sees challenging times ahead, to say the least, for the financial markets and investors, which requires a sea change in investment strategy and tact. Welcome, Christopher.
Thank you so much for having me on. I'm very excited for this conversation.
You know, we were having a interesting discussion before the interview, and you hate to lose that because we want the listeners to hear people's innermost thoughts. And we were comparing and contrasting, if you will, how important it is to catch these major themes and trends that oftentimes the mainline media, they just don't give you the heads up. And one of those themes was the housing crisis, where apparently you were a year ahead of my family. We sold in near the peak in 2006. You say that you sold your house in New Jersey in 2005. Tell us more.
Sure. Yeah, it was July of 2005, and my wife was actually 7 months pregnant with our first child, and I took the very odd idea of that we were in the middle of a housing bubble and that things were going to not end well and that I should cash out while I was still ahead. Basically, I woke up in May of 2005. I realized that the Federal Reserve was a privately owned company that created all this wealth, that the government was manipulating interest rates down, that the consumers were buying stuff that they couldn't afford, that the documentation process that was involved in this housing bubble was allowing people who couldn't even buy cars 2 years ago now buy $500,000 houses in my area. And I said, that's enough for me. We actually sold everything, and I put all the proceeds into gold and silver back in 2005. So I did two very odd things by not going against the trend in the housing bubble and then buying the stuff called gold and silver, which I had no clue about, you know, months prior. But I knew that that was the place to be for the next decade.
But, you know, you also talked about, or we talked about, how you had to go against not only the mainline thinking, but also against the general prevailing thought within your circle of friends and family. And I think that for most people, that contrarian perspective against peer pressure is one of the tougher things to wrap their minds around. Thinking outside the box can be challenging. Tell folks how you were able to make that leap of faith.
The only way you can do it is by using logic. You can't listen to everybody. Studies have shown that people will intentionally choose the wrong answer simply to conform with the collective. And, you know, any amount of psychological tests will prove that. Well, if that's the guiding force of most people's thinking, being the rational individual, you have to think outside the box. And, you know, that's where I think logic comes in. And it allowed me to basically look at this world and look at the facts. Don't look at the emotion of what's going on. And then predict what's the most likely outcome of this. Can this go on forever? Most trends usually don't. They usually end horribly. And the best thing to do is basically, you know, keep questioning the reality that's out there, and you'll be far off better. Like I told you in the pre-interview, you're not going to be able to day trade by this by any means, but you can certainly be on the right side of history when it matters the most.
It's so easy to look back, isn't it, in the rearview mirror and say, oh, well, it was obviously a housing peak. Most people missed it, though. What really grabbed my attention, and I held on to it, even wrote about it in Wealth Building Strategies 2006, 7, and 8, was the reset of the subprime and related adjustable rate mortgages and all the different classes in there. I held on that, and my thinking was, you know, until we can get this glut of inventory, this shadow inventory washed out of the system, I just couldn't fathom how we could see a bottom before around 2011, 2012. Well, that just came to pass. Let's move on. You talk about traditional investing methodologies. You expect them to backfire. A different mindset is required to be rewarded by big profits. Give us an idea of what you see on a forward-looking basis.
Look at the S&P 500. I mean, if you look at the peaks in 2000 and 2008, those were obviously bubbles back then, and now we're leap years beyond that. I mean, there is, since 2013, this market's been literally on a 45-degree angle straight up, without even pullbacks of even more than, you know, 4 or 5%. And each pullback that they have is smaller and smaller. They used to have a, you know, 10% pullback, 7% pullback, 5% pullback, and then move up. Now it's getting, hyperbolic the way that it's going. So conventional wisdom would tell you right now, oh, the stock market's doing well. I tell you what, I don't hear anybody talking about the stock market like they did in 2000. I just think that it's a terrible place to be. That's not to say that I would short that market, simply because the underlying bubble that's driving all of this is the dollar, and that's what I'm most concerned about, and that's the biggest reason why I invest in gold and silver, is because that the underlying currency that's denominating the bond bubble, the real estate bubble, the stock market bubble, the American bubble, is horribly being undermined right now, and I don't think it's going to survive. So that's the main reason why I buy this gold and silver, is because it's insurance against real tangible wealth in your hands against all this intangible claims on future wealth, which is what the dollar is.
I liken the erosion of a currency to, think of the Golden Gate Bridge, or maybe just the interstate bridge in your community. You know, they build these giant edifices based on steel structures surrounded by concrete. If any water really seeps in there and erodes the rebar, the steel underlying the mechanism, you can have a failure in a moment's notice, and the whole thing, the whole edifice, comes crumbling down. Well, that's, I think, an apt analogy. 1 million people a year cross the bridge in your community, and they think nothing of it. They're doing 55, 65 miles an hour. Everything's fine. And then suddenly, just the corrosion of that steel entered, and the whole thing comes tumbling down. Could we see something sudden like that with our currency? And what would it mean for investors?
I don't see how we can possibly avoid it. I mean, show me one, you know, fiat currency that's lasted as long as the dollar, and I'll show you 5,000 of them that have collapsed, horribly. And people that have been involved in having their wealth denominated in it have always come out the worst part of it. So people don't forget, or people do forget, that in 2008 we were within hours of the entire world economy collapsing. I have Representative Ken Jankowski out of Pennsylvania giving C-SPAN testimony, talking about how there was an electronic run on the bank, and that $5.5 trillion was pulled out of the money market account within an hour. I mean, that's a third of the United States' yearly GDP was pulled out of the money market funds because there was an electronic run on the bank. And they talked about if the government didn't step in, that would have been it. I mean, literally within hours on that day. And yet it passes. Nobody noticed that day. And even now, people still trust the system. I don't understand why people would even have a dollar inside the banking system, knowing how fragile it is.
I'd like to just delve into why this is so significant. We're bombarded, aren't we, with information from every source, whether it be mainline media or the blogosphere, just an overwhelm of information. However, at the end of the day, when you take a look at the charts going over, you know, that period from 2000, let's say 8, we came within hours, not days, from the end. Look across the board, nearly anything related to bonds, anything related to stocks, with very few exceptions. And as you say, without the Federal Reserve and their colleagues stepping in with an unimaginable amount, the Fed may have extended as much as $17 trillion to Europe and around the world just to keep this house of cards from imploding. So tell us more.
My thinking is that people that, you know, didn't learn the lesson in 2008 are going to lose everything this next crisis. Yeah, they were fed up with the wars, but you know what? Hope and Change Obama was coming. He was going to solve everything. So that happened right as the people still had faith in Greenspan and Bernanke and this almighty wisdom of what happened. They even had faith in Wall Street. And now I think that since this crisis and the systemic damage it has done, you know, you can look at the labor participation rates, and you can look at all the bailouts, and you can look at the lack of jail time of any of these Wall Street guys that, you know, pilfered billions of dollars from the taxpayers. No punishment handed down. You can't tell me that the psychology now, today, with people who have lost their jobs, people who have lost their savings, people who have lost their faith in the politicians and the banking system are going to roll over again the next time that this happens. And it's going to be magnitudes worse because the problem was not solved in 2008. It was kicked down the road. And you mentioned before $17 trillion by the Federal Reserve. That's just what they admit to. We have no clue of what has been going on behind the scenes. What's most important is that since 2008, you look at what China has been doing, Russia has been doing, Iran has been doing. They've been slowly eking away, getting away from the dollar. And you're going to wake up one day and find out that all these nations that have held this world's reserve currency, the next crisis, are going to dump it on the markets. And the value of those dollars are only determined by how many of them are floating around out there. And right now, they're sitting around. But I'm telling you, the next crisis that's going to happen, you watch that dollar price go down, and they're going to throw it at anything that they can, oil, gold, silver, copper, food, corporations. They're going to throw it at that because those at least have some value. These dollars are just future claims on wealth. People need to know that. Your bank deposits, you're a lender to the bank. You have no security in that. So I recommend people stop, you know, holding their wealth in intangible things and hold real wealth, which is what gold and silver represents.
The tragedy here, if you will, for lack of a better word, is that we had the opportunity, didn't we, to clear the system? We had the opportunity 2008 and 2009, instead of bailing out the banks with trillions of dollars, we had the opportunity to let the banks fail, to go into foreclosure, to press the reset button. You can take a look at what Sweden did in a similar situation on a miniature scale. They let the banks fail, and then they combined all of the bad debt in one sort of centralized location and managed that. They emerged from this a remarkably powerful economy. Their neighbors to the south, and both of them emerged from the problem by recognizing, look, we've learned our lesson. We don't want your toxic debt. We don't want to import your disease. All right. We don't want to fall into this debt trap, and they've avoided it ever since. So there's a lot, I think, to be learned from there. Any comments?
Yeah, I mean, think about human nature. I mean, we're a country that's absolutely drunk on power, drunk on we create debt out of nowhere. That's all we do. We don't produce anything anymore. We have more people that are that are unemployed, that, you know, out of the labor participation of the economy, and we're a nation that has gotten something for nothing for a couple generations. And when this ends, the drunk only changes when he hits rock bottom. And I don't expect people to wake up. I don't expect any grand reform. There's no political savior that's going to come in and save this system. The only thing that's going to happen and the only thing that's going to change is that we have to have a collapse. People think that, these great depressions and economic crises are something to be avoided. No, I think the greatest personal things in my life have been the biggest setbacks. Well, that's going to be the same thing for us. We need to have this collapse, to reset our values, to bring back productive forces into our economy as opposed to just these Ponzi scheme distractions that we have. We need this, and it's coming. And all I can tell individuals to do is you have to individually prepare for this collective fate that's coming.
Let's take a look at the bail-ins. I think this is an excellent segue into another topic I'd like for us to discuss today. And it all ties in with the noose that's being dropped around all of our necks collectively. Take a look at bail-ins. I mean, we've seen what happened in Europe. Now we're seeing legislation written in Canada and the United States, all over North America. The powers that be are aware that the system is imploding. It may be a slow motion train wreck, but it is inevitable. Okay. And if you see this coming and you're aware of it, you can start to take some measures. Why should people be nervous about their money market funds? Is it really safe as money in the bank?
No, it isn't. I mean, you're a unsecured creditor. You look up any legal definition of somebody that deposits money at a bank, you are an unsecured creditor. That's the lowest form that you could possibly be. And if you give your money to the bank, you're literally giving it to them. You know, they're supposed to give it back, but you're an unsecured creditor during the most difficult of times. So, you know, I don't have any stock money in the account. Everything that I other than a month's worth of, you know, cash to keep the house moving along, everything else is out of it and put it into the gold and silver. And that's the way that it should be, because that's real tangible wealth. You know, that's something you can hold. You know, if you went through any time in history and you told humans, you know, 100, 200, 300,000 years ago that, oh, look, I have a little screen that says I have $1 million and I can go buy this super fast Ferrari, that's the overriding theme of what's going on. And I can assure you that when this collapse happens, our grandchildren will look back at us and think about how that we actually trusted the worst in humanity on Wall Street and Washington with all this money, and that we thought that these computer screens actually meant something. No, we're going to get back to biblical wealth. We're going to get back to gold and silver and what you're, you know, land and productive and factories and things that actually provide real value to humanity, not these scams and schemes that are producing millionaires left and right and billionaires, you know, all over the place. You know, look at the people that are making the most amount of money right now, and they provide the least amount of value. The rock stars, the lawyers, the lobbyists, the military contractors, they don't provide any real value to humanity. And yet the people that do, the electricians and the teachers and the farmers, they're barely eking by. When the dollar collapses, you'll see a reversion where those that actually produce real wealth come out of this far better off and actually take the burden that has been placed on us.
Well, you know, it's interesting because I talked to G. Edward Griffin last week and several other guests recently. You know, why is it that people can't recognize how corrupt the system is? They fall into it and it almost becomes second nature. And I think when you're born into a system, it's almost like the Matrix. You know, I hate to use the overused, the tired analogy of, you know, Morpheus and Neo and the rest, but I mean, you're really born into the Matrix, and we have been here. I think you'd agree, ever since at least Nixon shut the gold window, but really it was long before then. It was when the creature from Jekyll Island was unloosed in 1913. Things just slowly erode, and if you're a student of history, you begin to realize it unfolds in a very similar path. No, it's not a perfect facsimile. It's cyclical, and you can see how morals erode in almost every instance where fiat money really took hold. And I think you'd agree there's never been a time in history where fiat money was more pervasive. We simply don't have a, thanks to Gresham's Law, I guess, a currency that is ubiquitously backed by precious metals anymore. It's just been pushed out of the system. In keeping precious metals on our minds here, let's move on to another topic that I know is near and dear to you and our listeners want to hear about, and that, of course, the London silver price fix. After 117 years, this has apparently come to a close. They have rejected it. Four or five of the top banks there used to agree each day on the silver price. And I wonder if you could tell people why you think this is a significant moment for the precious metals markets.
I think the only thing that matters before and after the London silver fix is the fact that Deutsche Bank was forced out by BaFin. BaFin is the German equivalent of like the SEC. And BaFin said that the manipulation in commodities and specifically precious metals was worse than the $800 trillion LIBOR scandal. And they forced Deutsche Bank to end that relationship with the London silver fix. So Deutsche Bank wanted immediately out of it, and the Bank of England somehow convinced them to stay on for 3 months to act as a buffer period so that they could establish a new one. So what they ended up doing is they ended up establishing a new one with, I think, replacing Deutsche Bank with Mitsui. And now it's an electronic system, supposedly more transparent. But it doesn't matter. I mean, it's a computerized paper scheme, and they could dump billions of dollars onto the paper market. No one's taking delivery from there. So I think at the end of the day, the manipulation is going to continue until it ends, and it's going to end horribly. There has to be a physical break in the market. There has to be physical shortages that override this paper market, and that anybody trading long or short in paper in these markets, are adding to the problems. They need to just simply buy physical silver, which is my preference over gold. And just wait for the day that it matters most. And to think that you're going to be able to get plus or minus 10% above the market and risk your whole amount of capital inside of that, I'm more concerned about the return of capital than the return on capital.
Will Rogers, if I'm not mistaken. And also Warren Buffett also echoed his sentiments. All right, you also investigate why most oversold markets make the largest returns. Silver, I think, certainly qualifies here. I mean, from a contrarian perspective, we've had quite a sell-off. I'd like to give you a chance here to outline what will be the impetus taking AG back to 50 and higher.
Well, I think ultimately a dollar crisis is what's going to propel it to these astronomical numbers, and I really refuse to put any dollar figure on it, because I think that the time that I've invested for silver is for the day that the dollar doesn't buy an ounce of silver anywhere. That it's just a failed currency, and that it could be denominated in billions or trillions, like we've seen in Zimbabwe or Weimar Germany. But think about it. I mean, in 2005, when I first started investing in silver, nobody talked about it. I mean, it was such a small piece. Like, I remember David Morgan and maybe one or two other guys out there really talking about it, but you couldn't find out much about it. And now that the whole blogosphere, I mean, there's tons of blogs and radio shows and all devoted to it now. So I think the awareness has reached a certain level now where people are out there. But look at the demand that has been driven on silver in coin sales since 2005, in solar power since 2005. The industrial demand has gone up significantly, and the biggest reason why I'm investing in it is because this is a precious and depleting resource that's absolutely vital to a modern way of life. And the United States Geological Survey, I think back in 2007, predicted that between 2020 and 2030, there would physically be no more silver on Earth. If we keep consuming the amount of silver that we have on a level, and we do consume it, like it's physically destroyed as in most of these processes, there will be no silver left anymore. And when I wrote the author of that study back, I think in 2010, I said, can you clarify that? And he said, well, unless there's a price change that allows more production to come online or wiser use of that silver, that's what's going to end up happening, because there's only a finite amount of the silver that's out there.
I'll give you an example. Today, I've been drinking from a Brita water filter. They take the carbon and they spray it with micro silver, and it's in everything. You'll never reclaim that silver again. You might be thinking, well, that's a minuscule amount. Yes, but there are millions of people using Brita water filters. Cell phones filled with tiny amounts of silver, your computer keyboard, it'll be tossed, very difficult to reclaim. The silver simply won't be reclaimed by anything much more than Mother Nature over millions of years, and it disappears for good. I'd also like to talk about an important aspect of silver, at least that economists like to look at, and that's its Giffen goods status. People know that have studied Econ 101 that Giffen goods have upward sloping demand curves. People have a tendency to consume more of it despite the fact that the price is increasing. That's not a positive factor, but when it comes to silver, due to the absolutely inelastic demand that we have, we just must have it, period. There are very few substitutes that are reasonable. You can't use gold, for instance, to replace that silver in electronics, not because it won't work, but simply because it's just too costly. This kind of seems to be setting the stage for an interesting scenario for silver investors. Please tell us more.
Yeah, I mean, you look at what's going on in India. They're going to build the world's largest solar farm. I think it's going to be miles big. I mean, it's a huge endeavor that it's going to have. And that alone is going to take up 10 million ounces a year. I think the United States Mint only, produces 40 million ounces of silver eagles a year. Right off the bat, that's more demand that's coming online. And we're having declining, finding of this stuff. And silver is also an interesting thing that it's relatively shallowly mined. It's not like gold where you can dig miles and miles down. And when it's shallow mined, that means it's depleted even faster. And you think about, 200 years ago, the gold to silver ratio was, 15 to 1. For every ounce of gold you found 15 ounces of silver. And now it's 1 to 9. For 1 ounce of gold, there's 9 ounces of silver. I mean, that's a significant drop just in the natural amount that's come out of the ground. And yet, where's gold and silver trading on the dollar market? I mean, we're like 1 to 65. 1 ounce of gold equals, 65, 67 ounces of silver. I mean, that's a huge wealth discrepancy in the pricing mechanism of that. I mean, reality is that it has to be at least closer to what is coming out of the ground, and I think it's even worse than that because all the gold that's ever been mined has been saved and treasured. And we've destroyed and burned through billions of ounces of stockpile, where I think that there's physically less silver above ground than there is gold.
You're absolutely right. Silver had a tendency to pull near the surface, and so most of the big finds have been found. Most of the Comstock loads, if you will, it's a thing of the past. So now most of our silver is a byproduct of copper and, of course, gold, nickel, if you will, but mostly copper production. But another topic you brought up that I think is so important and central to the theme of silver's value, intrinsic value on a forward-looking basis, and that's solar production. I have a solar array with 10 panels. We produce a kilowatt per hour at peak. Every one of these panels has at least an ounce of silver. That's an ounce of silver that could never be reclaimed. It would not be cost effective with silver anything less than $100 to $200 an ounce. It's gone forever. And you touched on this. India, very much inclined to build these solar arrays, but so is China and Germany and all over Europe. And the United States is only now coming online because I think we were disappointed by Jimmy Carter's push around the 70s wasn't cost effective, but solar power has come a long way in 20, 30 years. You can get an amazing amount of output at a very low cost, pure sine wave inverters, which allow your sensitive electronics, your latest computers, laptops, and related technologies to run without a glitch. Battery storage, it's very inexpensive relative to where it was a few decades ago. So even I think the more modest middle class home is starting to look at it. But there's another wild card that I hope some of my listeners have picked up over the years, and that is grid-tie inverters. Plug that power without a battery bank, without much of a solar array, with a very small investment. You can use a grid-tie inverter, not in all areas. You plug that right into the wall, and your meter will start to run backwards. And once again, an inexpensive technology. And please, by the way, for our listeners, don't run out and buy a grid-tie inverter until you've talked to your local power company. But for a lot of people, it is an option that's available. And once again, silver will be in big demand there for decades to come. Christopher Duane, it's been fun having you on the show. Why don't you tell folks more about the services you provide and how people can direct their web browsers to your sites?
My YouTube channel is called The Truth Never Told. It's on YouTube. We've got 72,000 subscribers and 15 million views. I have the Silver Shield Exchange and Silver Shield Collection. These are coins that I've designed myself. We have our own marketplace for them. They're very different. I've tried to create a privately minted coins because I find that ironic that so many people hate the dollar and what's going on in the world and then go rush out and go buy silver from the United States Treasury. So I think that we should be supporting privately minted solutions, and these are definitely unique coins that, I think most people will like.
And by avoiding the cartel that is likely behind much of our oppression and the powers that be, there are alternative sources. Do you want to share any more specifics there?
This is my third year. I've probably designed 25 different coins, and I have probably another 20 that could come out in, any time. But they're unique pieces that I call them historically significant because they call out both the good and the bad of what's going on in this world. I mean, I've done coins that mock, you know, debt and death empire, that we've spread all this war and we, you know, rally around all these flags. I've done coins that have talked about the trivium, which is grammar, logic, and rhetoric on how to free the individual's mind from this collective oppression that's going on there. I did Freedom Girl. I've done so many designs out there, but they're all unique, where I think, you know, the wonderful thing about these silver coins is they're going to be around 200, 300, 400 years from now, just like the Roman coins were. And future generations are going to look at these designs and go, not everybody went along with what was the mainstream out there, that big dollar collapse that changed human history.
You might recall how it certainly appeared as though there was a collected effort against one of the fathers in this area, you know, the founding fathers, and that's, of course, Bernard von Nothaus, how his life was just systematically destroyed when he created that Liberty Dollar, I think he referred to it. Beware on the specifics that are minted, which I'm sure you've already taken caution.
I learned a great deal of adolescence from Bernard's unfortunate case. I ran to his defense when he was called a domestic terrorist. For that, we have a privately owned Federal Reserve that's funding all these wars, and I would they turn a blind eye to them, obviously, because it's in the power, and Bernard was obviously challenging the status quo. But yeah, none of my coins say dollar on them, have dollar symbols, values on them. They can never be mistaken for any legal currency, and they're all denominated in what the only thing that I measure my wealth in is ounces.
Christopher Duane, we're going to look forward to having you back on the show.
I appreciate it, and I had a great time.
Well, it's a pleasure to have James Turk back on the show, founder of GoldMoney.com, author of The Coming Collapse of the Dollar and How to Profit from It.
Yeah, thanks, Chris. It's good to be with you. And there is indeed a new book. It's called The Money Bubble, What to Do Before It Pops.
I'm sure it's a must read. And I wonder if we could start today with the summer doldrums in the precious metals. Typically, though, as the fall approaches, we have the Indian wedding season, as well as Christmas, Hanukkah, and related holidays. As fabricators and manufacturers stock up on the metals, it tends to be a more positive time, at least for a price, and give some support. Tell us what you see happening in the markets, please.
Yeah, let's look at it from a big picture point of view, because I think that's what's really important. The low in this correction that began 3 years ago was actually in June 2013, you know, over 14 months ago. And the gold price has been slowly climbing higher. In other words, the low was in June of 2013. We had a higher low in December of 2013. We had a higher low again in June of 2014. And now we're testing that June of 2014 low. And I expect that June of 2014 low will hold. You know, what I'm basically saying is that we're in a bull market, higher lows over a period of 14 months. And during a bull market, at the beginning, you're typically characterized with, as they say, climbing a wall of worry. And, you know, everybody's worried here. Are we going to take out the June 14 low or the December 2013 low? Well, we'll see how it plays itself out. But I think the important thing that everybody should be focusing on is that, you know, gold is exceptionally good value down here. And as you say, seasonally, we're going into the seasonally strong time of the year. So one has to expect that, yeah, we're probably going to hold here and move higher as we go toward the end of the year. You know, we're actually up for the year, even though we're down. You know, it seems like, you know, we've been coming down the last few months. We're actually up about 5% for the year. So we'll probably have it up here again in the gold price when we finally get around to December 31st.
All eyeballs seem to be on U.S. equities right now. You know, the investment du jour that has captured the attention and fascination of hedge fund managers and the momentum crowd. We also, I think, see a slight flight to safety, perceived quality, I think, from Europe, at least on the Ukraine-Russia tensions that we've seen there and the potential for a new Cold War. And maybe that's a good segue into geopolitical issues. There's quite a few on the table because you are right there in Europe, this Ukraine situation. I think it could be an important piece on the chessboard in coming years for the precious metals.
Yeah, it doesn't look like the Ukraine situation is going to be resolved anytime soon. You know, even though they have a ceasefire in place, it's a question how long that will hold. And then The other issue, of course, is the sanctions that are being pursued, you know, the ones the West are imposing on Russia and the ones that Russia are imposing on the West. In that kind of environment, everybody loses. You know, it's not a shooting war, but it's a war, a financial war. And in a war, regardless whether it's a financial war or a shooting war, you know, everybody loses. You know, what's happening now is that economic activity is declining because of the sanctions. And then there's also the uncertainty as to, you know, what Russia is going to do with regard to its natural gas exports, which Europe actually depends upon. So I think geopolitical issues are going to be around for a long time. There's also a minor geopolitical issue right here in the UK. You know, I'm speaking to you from London, and next week the Scots are going to vote on whether or not to declare independence from the United Kingdom. And I think that could have shockwaves. It's already had impact on the pound sterling, which has been very, very weak as the pro-independence movement has gained momentum and actually taken the lead in the polls. And there are other areas in Europe that could have an impact. For example, in Spain, whether if Scotland successfully breaks away from the United Kingdom and declares independence, what is the Catalonian region of Spain going to do? So, you know, basically people want control of their own destiny. And I think we're seeing that. It's been a trend in place for many, many years. And I think it's going to continue to be a major geopolitical force.
You know, it's interesting because I have family in London that were here recently visiting. Our U.S. dollar caught in a multi-year trading range within an even longer-term downtrend. And I wonder if you might bring together this concept of the reserve currency, its loss of hegemony, and how this could impact our purchasing power and on the geopolitical stage in the coming decade.
First of all, you know, the dollar has bounced. I wouldn't say the dollar is strong. It's more a question of the dollar being the strongest in among a number of weak different currencies. You know, the dollar is bound simply because sterling has been weak and the euro has been weak because of issues relating to, you know, what's going to happen if Scotland becomes independent, what's going to happen in Europe because of the Ukraine and the bad European economy. But, you know, I think what history shows is that only strong currencies become reserve currencies. And, you know, when the sterling, British pound sterling, lost its status as a reserve currency, there was another currency waiting in the wings, which, of course, was the U.S. dollar, which, as they used to say back in the 1960s and before, was as good as gold. You know, that's no longer true because, you know, the dollar has been a very weak currency over the past several decades. But there is no obvious currency waiting in the wings to replace the U.S. dollar. So, you know, there could be a lot of turmoil in the international monetary system over the next several years for that reason, as well as for the reason that central banks are continuing to follow these misguided policies, you know, thinking that they can solve all of the world's economic problems by printing money. And we know from monetary history that, in fact, is not the case.
The fundamentals are just overwhelmingly strong, I think you'd agree, for the prospects of the metals, given all the issues you've touched on today. But the longer-term view, I think, is, at least technically speaking, is somewhat problematic. You know, maybe not the XAU so much, which appears to have washed out.
Yeah, I don't really think there's a new Dow trend. I still see what's been happening over the last 3 years of a correction of the previous 10 years, or 12 years, you know, when gold went up 12 years in a row. So I just see this as a correction, and this year's probably, like I say, going to be an up year. You got to take the long-term, big picture view of gold and of silver, and you have to ask yourself, you know, where are you going to save money today? It doesn't make sense to save a national currency because you don't get anything, any interest income on your bank account, and inflation is higher than the interest rate you receive on your currency, so you're effectively losing purchasing power. So my strategy has been for many, many years, and I continue to recommend this, is that the money that you save every month, that should just go into physical gold or physical silver and just play the long-term trend. The long-term trend has been up for the metals for, you know, 14 years to below in 1999. And every reason suggests, based on what's happening with central banks and government policies, that that's going to continue to be in place. So I've got to remain bullish on the precious metals, and I think precious metals are an important part of everyone's portfolio.
We've seen a flood of interest into equities, new highs, it seems, every week. The S&P 500, the Dow Jones Industrials, highest points, at least in the Dow, in over a century. The NASDAQ appears to be en route to its year 2005,000 peak, only a few hundred points away from that level. Is this a knee-jerk reaction following a 10-plus year consolidation in equities? And if so, do you see big equity flows and capital flows away from that market into the commodities and particularly precious metals?
You know, there is a bubble being blown out there, and it's called the money bubble. You know, it's the belief that national currencies are going to maintain purchasing power when, in fact, they're losing purchasing power all of the time. It's the misguided belief that government debt is supposedly a safe haven and the currencies that's denominated in are safe. But in reality, they're not. So, you know, that's where the bubble is. And then the equities, I think, are responding to that bubble. You know, the Federal Reserve has printed trillions of dollars of new currency through expansion of its balance sheet. And that money has to go somewhere. And where it's going is into the equity market. The equity market isn't rising because of good economic conditions. That won't happen until we have more people working in the country than there were at the peak of 2007. You know, we still have less people working than the peak of 2007, and adjusted for purchasing power and inflation, average family or average household real income is less than it was, you know, 7 years ago. So in those kind of environments, you're not going to have a good economy, regardless of what the government says. The stock market's going up simply because of Federal Reserve money printing. And if the Federal Reserve stops printing, and that's what they're basically been doing, they've been cutting down on the amount of quantitative easing they've been doing, and they say they're going to end quantitative easing in the fall. You know, that I think is going to create problems for the stock market, similar to what it did in 2011 when the Fed stopped printing for a period of time. And that was a very bullish environment for gold. So, you know, going toward the end of the year, I think everything's lined up for higher gold and silver prices.
I wonder if you'd like to share any contact information and what's going on at goldmoney.com, please.
Yeah, you can find us at goldmoney.com. Not only the work that I do, but also my colleague, Alistair McLeod, who's the research director at Gold Money. Thank you, Chris.
It's time to get caught up with listeners' questions. So, opening up the phone line.
Hello, Chris Waltzek. My name is Jimmy, and I'm calling to make a comment about today's, the latest Gold Seek radio show that had Louis Navalier and Bob Hoy on it, of course, with Robert Ian at the end. Anyway, I wanted to say that at about the 27-minute and 56-second mark on today's show, Louis Navalier, and I've listened to him before. I mean, of course, you've had him on before, and I've heard him before. At 27 minutes and 56 seconds, he says how Social Security and some of these other things appear to be pyramid schemes, so we need to get more people paying in. After hearing that, and from hearing him before as well, you know, I'm not going to listen to any of the rubbish that guy has to say at all. Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Well, hello, Jimmy. I can understand your frustration, you know, with some comments. However, sometimes we put our foot in our mouths, don't we? Because none of us are perfect. So I guess we're all due some leeway with the occasional slip up. And it's a good thing, too, because, you know, I step in it from time to time, and I'm grateful when folks chuckle and forget all about it and we move forward. He's been a big friend of the show for nearly a decade, and he's the only advisor that I would point to who's been consistently right on the equities markets. His services and stock picks are simply the best. You know, I recommend him along with my Alpha Stocks newsletter and the stock candidates. So let's appreciate, you know, our guests' gifts and maybe overlook the occasional blemish. We appreciate your comments, though, and we'd like for you to stay with us here if you can hopefully get past your feelings. And remember, folks, the toll-free hotline is available for you all 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 1-800-507-6531, 507-6531. please jot this down on a Post-it pad and or plug it right into the cell phone or your home phone. 1-800-507-6531. You can call anytime. It's automated. You can cancel, delete, get it just right if you'd like. Even remain anonymous if you prefer. 1-800-507-6531. We'd like to field your questions and listen to your comments. All right, opening up the digital mailbag for all of our listeners' email questions. Jason writes in with a question regarding investing and financial advice. He says he's looking for financial education for income purposes, and his goal would be to start using my Alpha Stocks newsletter and understanding just what's going on. He did subscribe for a while, and he has the book, and he'd like to join one of my online courses through North Dakota State University to supplement his income and understand even better. You know, hi, Jason. You know, it sounds like you're on the right pathway to success, and I applaud your initiative. Investing for income purposes for the typical investor, though, I think is fraught with intense hurdles and challenges. I try to advocate building a diverse portfolio, which includes higher than average dividend and coupon interest. Maybe it's somewhat boring, but it is that passive form of income that works so well for most investors. Active trading for income is simply a dangerous path for 90% of folks. I mean, for instance, you've probably heard the fastest way to turn your brokerage account into a balance of $1 million is to start day trading with $1 billion. I give a hat tip to the successful day trader listening, emphasis on the singular and not plural. I don't want to discourage anyone from seeking profits, but would encourage folks to keep pursuing knowledge from this program, the Alpha Stocks newsletter, and every source possible. You know, 90% of well-diversified high-income portfolios outperform active traded accounts. In fact, I'll bet the number is much higher than that. So really, why take the chance? Once you've built up a solid nest egg, if you'd like to speculate, well, even then, caution is advisable. Just remember that precious metals should be the backbone of every portfolio, at least 25% weighting. And in my case, it's over 75%. But then, you know, I'm partial to the sector. Jason, there are some fantastic free educational resources online, such as Dr. Schiller's Yale University lectures, just one of my favorites. In fact, when I taught through North Dakota State University, my online graduate course, and keep in mind, that was 4 or 5 years ago before I had actually worked on my PhD. I was really just learning the ropes then. But I can tell you that I loved directing folks to every one of his videos, virtually every one of Dr. Schiller's Yale Econ and Finance lectures are just fantastic. And the fact that he was kind enough to give that away to free to society really, I think, speaks volumes of the individual. But he's brilliant and at an Ivy League school, and it's just available to you as though you were sitting in the class. So I'd recommend watching them each video multiple times, starting with maybe just one a night after dinner or after studies. I'm partial to Clemson University and Mercer University, as well as my online school, North Central University. I'm sending over email links to Dr. Schiller's video lectures to you, and I'd like for you to stay in touch, and please keep me updated regarding your progress with these video lectures. If you have any questions, I'll try to field them. You're on the right path. Longtime listener Paula writes that she's a lifetime Alpha Stocks subscriber and faithful listener, would like links to Seth Klarman's digital book. She says she's out of the market. She read Nassim Taleb's book, Anti-Fragile, and has been purchasing hard assets ever since. Purchased two battery generators with solar panels, a portable heater, emergency radio, lantern, and other things as well. Now saving in order to purchase dehydrated food. Enjoys reading the newsletter and listening to the show. Well, hi, Paula. You know, absolutely. I have already sent over a digital link to the free copy of Mr. Klarman's book. I mean, you know, it's still must read. And last check, about 15 minutes ago, $1,500 to $2,000 a copy on eBay, because folks just didn't recognize, the publisher didn't recognize what they had at the time. They stopped publishing his book, and he has not allowed it to be published since. So basic supply and demand has certainly pushed prices up. I can see why you are concerned by equities price valuations. Extraordinarily high by most metrics. Nevertheless, momentum could push prices maybe even higher, similar to our 2000.com bubble. But I do concur that commodities, in particular the precious metals, will remain the red hot sector to accumulate when possible. As for survival, it sounds like you're making solid steps to protect against the tidal wave of big changes and challenges that will be facing the Western world. As the dollar implosion regains momentum, I expect widespread food shortages similar to Katrina, which could result with, you know, chaos that will stem from the loss of potable water, related resources such as electricity. If you're like me and you expect problems to persist for years and not just months, generators, I think, will be of marginal use because, well, it will be challenging to refine gasoline. And even if it's available, the cost will be prohibitive. And then, of course, there's the drive, the commute, and from the gas station and back may be risky amid potential roving gangs, hijackings, random shootings. There are several self-contained solar units available. It sounds like you're already on that path that can easily be stored, quickly set up on, let's say, a back deck, out of sight, out of mind. The units have built-in batteries and inverters and can provide enough electricity to run, say, a small microwave for a limited time, a single stovetop, an LCD TV, laptop computer, coffee makers, can openers, you know, all the basics you'll need to stay sane and safe during extended outages. In addition, in cold climates, contingencies are essential to survive the brutal cold weather extremes, such as stockpiling firewood, natural gas, and then there's canned food as well as freeze-dried foods. We never throw out canned foods, even past expiration, because of reports that show that well-cooked expired canned foods are usually edible without any botulism issues. Now, of course, this is not a recommendation, but during extreme emergencies, i.e. starvation, canned foods without even labels, I'd suggest networking with other preppers in your area, and this is going to take some careful evaluation on your part, using preppers as maybe the first keyword term search, and best of luck. Please keep us updated on your progress. Well, next, James says, Chris, I never had a chance to thank you for having Rob Kirby on the show, so thank you. It was one of your best shows and would be great if you could have him back on the show. Well, that's really kind of you to say, James. I'm glad you enjoyed it. I think we all got a lot from Rob Kirby. Whether you agree with his thoughts or not, no one, I think, can debate the fact that this fellow is incredibly knowledgeable. His experience is extensive in the financial markets. Okay, moving on. Bill writes that he wants to thank us for the shows. Well, thanks, Bill. I'm glad you're getting a lot from the show. And moving on. And next up, it's Vidya. He shares my passion for animals and animal rights. Adopting puppies that have broken hind legs need medical treatment. They're also trying to protect calves from slaughter. And has a young friend who started a business for online vegan. And they do lots of rescues. He says that, you know, financial support is so important when it comes to saving animals. Unfortunately, it's just so difficult to come by. And he asks if I am vegetarian, vegan, and what I do to support animal rights. Well, hi, Vidya. Doing my best to live in all vegan clothing, vegan shoes, belts, wallets, furniture, animal friendly. A mostly vegetarian diet. I have cut out all meats, but as a pre-diabetic, glucose levels can sometimes require some non-friendly products. And of course, doing everything I can to focus primarily on nuts, noodles, beans, lentils, grains and potatoes, and other vegetables. You know, regular supporter of a group that rescues dogs from shelters in this area and then ships them to pet-friendly states where their neuter and spay laws keep the population so low that they're in high demand. So they're saving hundreds a year. Also belong to three animal rights groups and a local animal shelter, the Humane Society. We only keep rescue dogs in our family. But it's still not quite enough. I wish that we could do more. Hopefully we will have more. And his next question is about the dollar rupee and things of that nature. And he wants to know what I think about the dollar. Well, you know, the dollar and the rupee situation, unfortunately, is set in stone, and that's zero value. I mean, simply the path obeyed by all paper currencies will be zero. But, you know, they have a tendency, the central banks, of keeping these things rolling along much longer than expected. So I think even Ramanujan would likely concur that if you're willing to be patient 5 to 10 years, your portfolio will be well rewarded for owning silver and gold. And I prefer silver. and continue to add regularly to my humble piggy bank, despite the fact that I think a capitulation may occur before our ultimate nadir. However, I recommend diversification among asset classes, including commodities, currencies, equities, global equities, bonds, real estate, energy. So please keep us updated on your efforts on behalf of birds, mammals, fish. Please let us know if you have any other constructive ideas. Up next, Robert says, thanks for the quick reply. When I tried to subscribe to your Alpha Stocks newsletter, I'd like to receive the $99 yearly deal. Can you please give me more? Yes, you know, I can help you out here, Robert. You will receive within 1 hour or less a refund for. So what happens is if you sign up for our $147 deal, you'll receive roughly a $47 refund almost immediately. So that'll take care of that for you there. And that's considerably more than 10%. Okay, thanks, Robert. Moving on, Brad says he likes to hear my thoughts and Gerald Celente's thoughts on nutrition and life. And he points out that he's in his 50s. And he was laid off. He says he has no debt. His house and car are paid for. But due to his job loss, his income level is very low, near poverty. He's been living off the cash he saved up with almost no expenses, which I think is clever. He does about 30 hours a week reading on the precious metals and finance and economics, which is fine. He'd like to know my thoughts on the fact that he's, like me, pre-diabetic, what to do, juicing, gardening, things of that nature, and future jobs as well as solar panels. So a whole lot of information, a lot of questions in here. He misses Robert Chapman, Bob Chapman, our dear late friend, like so much of us here. Well, let's see if I can cover most of the things here. I think I've already talked a bit about the solar panels, so we can skip that. I think I've talked a good bit about where to get started with the precious metals and finance, so maybe we can skip that as well. As far as diabetes and juicing, you know, I've been a huge believer in vegetable juicing now for over 15 years. I've been juicing primarily things like cucumbers, carrots, and I love lettuce, spinach, any greens you can think of that are edible are great for juicers. As for diabetes, here's my recommendation, and most people probably won't follow it, but cut out anything sweet. I mean, if it has cane syrup, corn syrup, anything that could even be slightly sugar in the label, my suggestion is to give it to homeless shelters and other folks in need where starvation is the primary concern and not perhaps chronic disease. I also recommend cutting out all fruits, and this is going to be difficult for most people, but I found it essential. Fruit juices in particular have a tendency to be concentrated, and that, of course, increasing exercise levels will become less and less difficult as you follow this advice because your energy level will skyrocket. And then, of course, if your kidney health is strong, you'll want to add in alpha-lipoic acid. Of course, talking to a physician first about all these ideas. I am not a physician, just a PhD candidate. As well as all of the essential nutrients like omega-3, vitamin D. This nation has an epidemic of vitamin D deficiency. And a little bit of magnesium, again, if your kidneys are strong. So these are just a few ideas to get you started. And please, by all means, check out Dr. Mark Hyman's videos on every subject, but in particular, diabetes and diabesity. I think it'll simply change your life. I know it has been a miracle and a blessing to my family. So I hope this all helps out. I'd like for you to keep in touch with me, and maybe we can do some networking to perhaps get you on a solid job path. All right, next up, Chef Snow writes in and says he's a big fan of the show, and he liked the Gerald Celente discussion where we talked about avoiding sugary tomato sauces. He says he wants everyone to know that he's created and manufactures his own line of 3 pasta sauces, Thoughtful Harvest. There's a free plug for you. He says most store-bought sauces contain foreign ingredients, contain bad ingredients, cheap commodities and oils. They're not organic or certified, and there's a lot of GMOs, sugars, and corns. And, you know, I can attest to this, Chef. I have eliminated it all. Tomato sauce was my biggest concern. You know, I was consuming just huge amounts of Italian/Sicilian family members, and so I was reared with a lot of sauces, tomato sauces, pizzas, linguinis, lasagnas. We were just heavy on the tomato sauce. So you're right. Way too much sugar. And actually, tomatoes, I make my own homegrown and organic tomatoes. You know, it's very easy to make your own tomato sauces. All you do is boil a large pot of water, throw the tomatoes in for just a few minutes, and then drop them in a bowl of cold water, and that blanches and removes the skins. They just fall right off. And then, of course, you can just blend them up or use a hand mixer, boil that down, and you'll find that you have fantastic sauces, which really don't seem to irritate pre-diabetes. So, folks, let me encourage you to check out Chef Snow's Thoughtful Harvest. There you go. Look for Thoughtful Harvest. You know, 100% certified, single estate, extra virgin olive oil. Sounds great to me. California-grown plum tomatoes. He's got a video. You can check it out at harvesteating.com. He has a blog as well. And Daniel, longtime listener and friend, Daniel says he hopes things are well, and he'd like to find a reputable precious metals seller that doesn't mark up Morgan dollars. He's noticed several have big-time markups. He's just not happy with them. I have just the place for you. It's Gold Eagle, and my suggestion is ask for Clint Stelfox. He's been just fantastic to us, and I highly recommend them. You might even mention that Chris sent you there, and no, I don't get any kickbacks or special favoritism or anything for it. It just might help you in your purchases. They have, I think, the best service and the best prices, and take it from a guy who's been in the market for decades. That's my suggestion, Gold Eagle. You might want to bookmark the site. Great to hear from you all. And don't forget, we'd like to hear your questions and comments. And, you know, the phone calls get top priority. We need to hear from some of our regulars out there. And you know who you are. Get on the horn and give us a call. Plus, there's many others we'd like to hear from. Just pick up the phone, give us a call. And you know that number by now, but why not say it again? 1-800-507-6531. What was that you say? 1-800-507-6531. We'd like for you to stay with us right here at GoldSeek.com Radio. More news and guest interviews coming right up at GoldSeek. Here is your mining quiz for the day, compliments of GoldSeek. Which company has the largest undeveloped gold reserve in North America? Seabridge Gold. Now, which company has the largest undeveloped copper reserve in North America? Seabridge Gold again. Seabridge has more gold reserves than Kinross, Yamana, and Agnico Eagle. Last year alone, Seabridge added 515 million tons of new inferred resources containing nearly 6 million ounces of gold and more than 6 billion pounds of copper at their giant KSM project in British Columbia, Canada. Now they are drilling at KSM again with multiple rigs in a 25,000-meter program. Find out more by visiting www.seabridgegold.net. Traded on the NYSE, symbol SA, and the TSX, symbol SEA.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.
The U.S. dollar continues to be plagued by fiscal irresponsibility and monetary profligacy. Our special guest today thinks that the greenback's days may be numbered. A new currency is inevitable. G. Edward Griffin, author of several best-selling hits, including, of course, The Creature from Jekyll Island, and he runs the Reality Zone with Joan Hunter. Welcome back, Mr. Griffin.
Well, thanks for inviting me.
You know, I wonder if we could start off with the U.S. dollar. You know, the halls of history, I think you'd agree, are lined with the carcasses of defunct currencies. The once mighty pound eventually gave way, the sterling, to the dollar. You seem to think the dollar may have to pass the torch as well, that its zenith could be approaching. A new currency might replace it.
Yes, the phrase passing the torch triggered a couple of thoughts. In the past, that was pretty much the case, that there was always one currency in the world or more that had some real value to it in the form of the productivity of the society, or preferably in the form of some kind of backing in terms of gold or silver, so that the money itself had some intrinsic value that was recognized universally for something other than money, which is what gives money its real backing. Money can survive and be accepted quite well for long periods of time, provided that the nation issuing it is a strong military force and can dominate the world. And, you know, you better you better like us or we'll send our troops over there and we'll call you terrorists or something. You know, that works for a long time, but then it fades, and maybe people get tired of playing that game, and those countries tend to overspend themselves, they become weak, and then they're replaced by another strong nation. So the torch was passed in the past, but today we're going through something a little bit different, and that is that all currencies in the world now are, the flame is going out, you might say, in the torch. Who are you going to pass it to? You might say, well, China, maybe, or maybe the Leninist bloc, you know. Who knows? Maybe there's some group in the Middle East that will back its currency by gold. They talk about that, but it's not really happened on any scale. So what's happening today, Chris, is that the bankers of the world who really now create the money, it's not the nations of the world anymore. It's the bankers that create the money. And anybody that has read my book, The Creature from Jekyll Island, they would know how that works. But we can come back to that perhaps later. The banks create the money in the name of the nation, and the money is just it's credit money and backed by debt. So all of these bankers now have played that game, and they've used it quite effectively to transfer wealth to themselves and their institutions. And now that process has gone about as far as it can go, because there isn't much more left, you know, to transfer. It's moving rapidly off in one direction. And so now what? Now what's the end game of that? And so all of these bankers and these various systems have been working together for quite some time to create a new currency, and it will not be a national currency this time. It will be an international currency. First, a regional currency like the euro. You know, that was the first step to get the currencies of Europe into a regional common currency produced by the European market, the European Union. And they're working on it, of course, in North America. They're calling it the AMERO. For United States, Canada, and Mexico, and that's not happened yet, but they're pushing it as hard as they can. And the grand design on all this is that after these regional currencies are established in Europe, North America, Asia, Africa, and the Pacific Rim, and so forth, and they have all of them in place, working on them, then the next step, after maybe 20 or 25 years, when that currency blows up and it suffers from the same fate of all fiat currencies, then they're going to transist into a international currency. Who knows what it'll be called, but perhaps it'll be called the Bancor. And then that's the end of the road, because there'll be no torch to pass. There'll be nobody to accept the new torch. The whole world will be saddled with one currency. It'll be essentially the same in character as all of the little fiat currencies that have been used by the various nations of the world. But it's the end of the process, because now the world is globalized, as they say. It's all one governance. It's all one currency, all one military force. It's all one world government, and that's the end of the line.
Well, that's a very succinct and tactful overview of what's going on, but I'd like more about how we got to this point. I mean, how we received the torch, and you alluded to that. You said you might be interested in maybe giving folks a primer here on just what the mechanisms are over the last century that led us to this point. Much of what's been fed to us in the mainstream may not be as accurate as we once thought. People are looking for answers. They want to know this topic of the evils of capitalism. I mean, we seem to run into this everywhere, but is it that maybe what we think of as modern capitalism has been mangled to such a point that, you know, that our forefathers wouldn't even recognize what we call capitalism today?
Yeah, those are two real meaty topics. I'm tempted to deal with that second one and forget the first one, but I guess we need to start first places first. Don't let me forget to get back to this so-called capitalism. But the history of how we got to where we are is a fascinating one. You said it's been going on for a century. The process is several centuries old. It started here in the United States a century ago, but the process has a code name to it that is used in the financial industry. They call it the central bank. That's the instrument or the institution that is that brings this to us, you know, coming to your country soon by a national or rather a central bank. And they call that thing a central bank. Our Federal Reserve is a central bank, and it's modeled after the Bank of England, which is the granddaddy, the original central bank. And all that means, first of all, central has some meaning because it means it's centralized and the power and the authority is all brought together in one place. It is a bank in a sense that people go to it and they use it as the medium for their transactions. They put their money into the bank. They borrow money from the bank and so forth and all of that. So In the modern sense, it is a bank. In the traditional sense, it's not, because what you put in there has no value. It's just an accounting program more than anything else. It's nothing of value. It's just numbers. But anyway, it's true. It's old. It's a couple of centuries old. And what a central bank really is, if you strip out the code name and just describe it in plain English, is that it's a cartel. It's a cartel of banks. It's in most countries, it's more than just one bank. It's several commercial banks that have come together and formed a cartel to protect their own interests. And then because they are so fabulously wealthy and they control the money system, they have unseen influence over the politicians in those countries. They literally buy and sell them like so many pounds of raw hamburger. And that part is not too visible to the average citizen. But when you think about it, he who has the money makes the rules. Well, the banks not only have the money, they make the money. And so they buy the politicians, and the politicians pass the laws that make everything that the banks, everything that they do, they make it legal. The same things that would be terribly illegal if you or I were doing it. We can't just go make money out of nothing and then put it into circulation and loan it out at interest. That's mainly what the central bank does. And they pay off the politicians and say, hey, this is all in the best interest of the nation. This is what we call credit. This is the modern banking system. And without it, we'll all be living in caves and eating meat. So everybody goes along with it. That's a central bank. It's a cartel, a group of private banks that literally control the money system, and because of that, they have great influence, if not total control, over their respective governments. So that's how we got there. In 1913, our central bank was passed into law. It was called the Federal Reserve System, but it was really modeled after the Bank of England. And when you look at the Federal Reserve, it is a cartel. It is not a government agency, although they went out of their way when they formed it in 1913. They went out of their way to make it look like a government agency. You know, they called it Federal Reserve, make it federal. It's about as federal as FedEx. And they have no reserves to speak of. It's all kind of a smoke and mirrors game. So we got there because the banks decided that they wanted to get ahead of the parade. And what I mean by that is that back in 1910, when they started to work on this, from 1910 to 1913, when this plan was put into operation, there was a hue and cry among the American people who wanted banking reform. They knew that there was too much power in Wall Street. They knew that these banks had too much control over credit and the economic flow and ebb of money in the society, and they wanted Congress to control those big bad banks, you know? And so the bankers decided, hey, why do we sit around and wait for Congress to do something and pass laws to regulate our industry? Let us be the ones that drafts that law to control our industry. And so they met in secret on Jekyll Island back in 1910. They prepared the basic outline of their cartel agreement of how they wanted their system to be operated by them, not by anybody else, not by the government. And then they took that cartel agreement to Washington, and they wrote across the top of that agreement the words Federal Reserve Act. Convinced them that they should pass their cartel agreement into law, which they did. And so now, by December, the end of December in 1913, the cartel agreement of the banking cartel became law. And ever since, you and I have had to abide by those terms, or we go to prison. And since it was passed into law, and there are prison penalties for disobeying that agreement, everybody thinks it's a government agency, but you could say, oh, only government can send you to prison, right? Well, no, wrong. The banks do. And so that, in a nutshell, is how we got there. It was trickery from the top to bottom. It was fraud and deceit, and it still is. It's even worse now than it ever was. And if you ever wonder what's really going on, just look at these bailouts and all these huge economic programs that they're passing in Congress. So they want $1 billion here and $1 trillion there to bail out the banks or bail out the Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac and bail out all of the savings and loan institutions and bail out General Motors, who have these huge loans to the banks, and they bail out Mexico, and they bail out other countries who have these huge loans to the banks and to keep those interest payments coming. And you look at all of this and you scratch your head, and if you forget the words that the politicians are using, like, we're doing this for you folks, we're doing this to save the system, we're doing this to save America, we're doing this, you know, for all these good reasons, so that children will have milk and all that sort of thing. But when you look at the result, where does that money go? Well, it goes to the banks. Every bit of it goes to the banks. And then you think, aha, I get it now. This is a banking cartel we're dealing with. And it's as simple as that.
But there's so many interesting facets to the story. For instance, originally, this was done covertly, I'm sure you agree, but I mean, my goodness, they're doing it right in front of our faces today. I mean, Goldman Sachs, they call it government Sachs at the Treasury Department now, because there's so many former key executives in the organization in Washington, D.C. There were other freedom fighters. You know, most people point to Thomas Jefferson and some of the others who warned of central banks, and they'd just seen what happened in the French Revolution and the heads rolling in the streets of Paris. Andrew Jackson comes to mind, the great central bank warrior, based his presidency on defeating the central banks. And it only took them a few more decades before they finally had the noose around our necks.
Yeah, the history is very, very strong with examples of this ongoing conflict. As you've just said, this is quite historical. It does go back a couple of centuries. And it's reaching the end game, though, and that's how we started this discussion. This only can go through so many cycles before it changes character. And it's reaching at the end of the game now, so that the character will change. It's not going to be just another economic cycle from which everybody recovers. You know, it's not just another depression and boom-bust cycle, all of that sort of thing. People take comfort in thinking, well, it's bad now, but it's been bad before, you know, and we always recover, don't we? This is a strong nation. Americans won't stand for any of this very much longer, you know, because these are good people and all that. And it's a comforting thought. But when you really look at the details of this historic fabric, you see that we're coming to the end of the rug. We're at the edge of the rug now, and the fabric is changing. And when we get off of the rug, we're into a whole new system. And that's what's really scary to me. As long as you can just look at it as a historical play on the stage, you know, it's fascinating, it's interesting, and you can say, well, I learned a lesson from that, and maybe I can protect myself and my family, and maybe, you know, we can do better. Maybe we can even take advantage of this, because it's possible along the way for people who are very smart and who understand this cycle to take advantage of it and make money while everyone else is losing money. But at the end of that process, you're off the rug, you're off the fabric, and you're on to the hard cement now. And I think that's, we're coming to that point. And let me explain what that means in my mind, at least. I think that the system is so strained that it will not be able to operate much longer as it has in the past. It is rapidly moving toward a command economy, such as we have seen very graphically in the Soviet Union. And even though they drop that for a while, they're returning to it also. All nations of the world now are returning to the Soviet style of administering economic and social policies and political policies. So we're coming now to a new stage in world history, for where the whole world is going definitely tyrannical. It's going into despotism, it's totalitarianism, and when you can no longer produce anything on the basis of economics, you know, that people want to go to work and they want to produce things because they have a profit motive, and they can provide for themselves by working hard and being innovative. When all that comes to an end, the only way you can make people work is to force them at the point of a bayonet. And, you know, you can herd them into trucks and put them into FEMA camps or work camps, or we used to call those concentration camps, but in Germany they called them work camps. You know, those, you get an impression that all those people in the concentration camps in Germany were just there to be slaughtered and gassed, and that's not true. They were there to work. Those were where huge factories were located, and those poor people were, most of them, were put into slave labor, and that's what goes on in China, too. So anyway, the world, I'm trying to get to the point, is the world is moving in that direction now, because only when the economy finally collapses and nothing works anymore, the only thing that's left is the raw power of physical force. And that's what scares me to death, because this is a new chapter in world history. And this time around, it'll be global. And so there would be no place to go and no one to whom to pass the torch.
Think about Orwell's 1984, the playbook for the powers that be today. They learned the lessons. You know, we have to admit that our overseers, if you will, learn from their own mistakes. And I think what they learned from those camps that you've referred to, and it wasn't just, by the way, World War II, and we can go back to all of European history and see the pogroms and so many horrible times where minorities and other outcasts were put into groups and forced into labor, or worse, serfdom, if you will, were hoodwinked into thinking, well, if I just pay my taxes, maybe I can beat this inflation. Oh, wait a minute, now the cost of goods have gone up so much higher, I can barely make ends meet. And then suddenly one little illness, one little accident on the way, the commute to work, and the whole house of cards implodes. There's no safety net. What contingencies can the everyday listener, the everyday investor, steps we can make to prepare now to help shield our families and friends against what we see coming?
That's a very important issue, and I'd like to address it, and I will. But before doing so, I'd like to point to a very important overview of this, which is that we'll be talking about short-term versus long-term preparation. What can you do on the short-term? What can you do for the long-term? The short term is pretty easy. It's right out of the textbooks. You know, you try and get out of debt, unless you're making money through debt, of course, and you're very confident that you can continue to sustain the debt and to pay the overhead. But to try and get out of debt, you certainly don't go into debt for consumption. You know, you don't go into debt to take a trip around the world. Live within your means. You try and get off the track of the train wreck. And by that I mean, we know that inflation is the great destroyer of fiat money around the world, and the United States is no exemption, has no exemption. So we're on the track, and we know that our money is going down, down, down in value every day, and yet we're saving money, right? And every day with that, our little nest egg gets smaller and smaller and smaller, and it's like being on this track, and you see this train coming down the track. I better get off this track, because if I keep all my savings and what little wealth I have in the form of money, like in a bank account or in an insurance policy, anything that's denominated in dollars, I'm going to be wiped out by that train. So the first thing is, hey, get off the track. Whatever savings you have, put as much of it as you can into something other than inflatable money. So that's the number one piece of advice I would give. And whatever that is, it sort of depends on your preferences. Gold and silver have always been a very good choice, but there are other choices too. You know, hard inventories are always good. Somebody said cynically the other day that they think that the best currency of the coming era will be bullets. And I had to stop and think, oh, wow, that's a very cynical, pessimistic view. But I had to say, you know, I'm afraid you're right. but you get the point that, you know, paper money will go the way of all other fiat money has always gone in history. So if you're depending on that for your future, you're making a big mistake. Now, the long view, however, though, is we must save the system, or we must change the system. We must get this collectivist mentality out of the minds of the people. people who believe that the group is more important than the individual, that the government is the representative of society, and the government is this great solver of all problems, and the government will take care of us. And if we can't provide for our health care, then the government should do that. If we can't provide for our housing, then the government should provide that. If we can't pay for education, then the government should do that. If we don't have enough food, well, the government should give us food stamps, and on and on and on. And this process, it has been going on, and you end up at that stage, and the first thing you know, we're totally dependent on government for everything. And if we're totally dependent on government, we can never be free, because you know, the hand that feeds you is the hand that controls you.
G. Edward Griffin, always a pleasure.
Well, thanks for inviting me, and good luck to you, and good wishes to your listeners.